coruscated with energy. I woke, soaked with night sweat, more out of my wide bed than in it. Dislodged bolsters were scattered over the floor. The Voxlink on my nightstand was beeping.
"Inquisitor Eisenhorn?"
"Sorry to wake you," said Matathene, "but I thought you'd want to know. The fleet exited the Immaterium 26 minutes ago. We are entering invasion orbit of 56 Izar."
Chapter 23. Invading the Invasion. Bent Angles. In the gardens of the Ceruthi. The war had already begun. 56 Izar hung like a pearl in space, milky white and gleaming. Vivid flashes and slower blossoms of destruction underlit its translucent skin of cloud. The heretic fleet had arrived 2 days ahead of us and had begun its assault of the planet. I kept thinking of it as Estrom's fleet, but it wasn't, of course. I had made certain of that. This was Locke's battle fleet now, I was sure. The 13 ships had blockaded 56 Izar in a non-standard but effective conquest pattern. Serial waves of their fighter bombers, interceptors, and dropships rained down on the planet, and the orbiting heavies bombarded the surface with their entire batteries. They detected our battle pack the moment we came out of warp. Their picket ships, the heavy destroyers Nebuchadnezzar and Fournier, wheeled round to protect their hindquarters. Admiral Spatian held our battle pack off orbit and chased the frigate's defense of Stalinvast, Emperor's Hammer, and Will of Iron straight in to clear the way. On their heels, he sent out the massed fighter squadrons of the expeditionary force and diverted the battleship Valpecula to engage the enemy flagship, a heavy cruiser named the Lioncur. The Emperor's Hammer and the Will of Iron pincered and torched the Nebuchadnezzar after a brief but fierce exchange. The explosion lit the void. The defense of Stalinvast and the Fournier locked each other tightly in a longer, slower dance of warships, and eventually slammed together, squeezing boarding parties and naval security units into each other's hulls. The locked ships tumbled away in an embrace of death. The Valpecula raced forward and misjudged the Lioncur's evasion, suffering a trio of broadsides. Coming about, spilling debris into the gulf, the Imperial battleship raised its guns and hammered the Lioncur so hard and so furiously that the enemy flagship broke up and blew out like a dying sun. Limping, the Valpecula turned slowly and began its long-range harrying of the enemy ships closer to the target world's atmosphere. Spatian committed the rest of his group then, ranging them forward in a three-pronged division, of which the central and largest was headed by the majestic St. Sithus. Distances closed. The near space of 56 Izar was awash with fire patterns and the streaking comets of missiles. Now the ferocious high-velocity small-ship phase began, as waves of interceptors and light bombers from both fleets met and buzzed around each other like rival swarms of insects. The tiny lights whirled and danced in the void, faster and more numerous than the unaided eye could follow. Even the tactical displays overwhelmed the senses. Pick plates flickering with thousands of type markers and flashing cursors, spinning, overlaying, vanishing and reappearing. The heretics had seeded a buffer zone behind their deployment with mines, and the Emperor's Hammer, spurring forward in a fleet intruder role, suffered heavy damage and was forced to break away. Heretic interceptors fell upon the stricken ship like carrion flies on a dying beast. The Will of Iron moved past the Emperor's Hammer, and began to sweep a path through the mine zone with its specialized clearing devices. Triggered by probing force cones, the floating weapons began to detonate in their thousands. Spatian's intent was to cut a wedge into the enemy's wide formation and bring at least some of his ships within range of the planet's surface. Once that bridging objective was achieved, he could begin to unleash the planetary assault, confident of providing the dropships with some covering fire. The St. Sithus was first to secure such a position. Its main guns mercilessly disposed of the heretic cruiser Scutum and forced the carrier frigate Glory of Algol into a desperate retreat. Hundreds of dropships rushed like a blizzard out of the battleship and the two frigates and the inquisitorial black ship that had moved in behind it. Most of the dropships were the grey landing boats of the Imperial Guard, jets firing as they hammered down into the cloudy atmosphere of 56 Izar. But scattered among them were a handful of scarab-black landing craft and drop pods of the Death Watch. The counter-invasion had begun. Within the first hour of the war, we managed to land more than two-thirds of our 120,000 Mayapois light elite infantry on the surface of 56 Izar, almost half of the motorized armor brigades, and all 60 Adeptus Astartes warriors of the Death Watch. Sensor sweeps showed 56 Izar to be a bland, unremarkable world beneath its heavy veil of atmosphere. Vast, low continents of inorganic ooze, punctured by ranges of crystalline upland and surrounded by inert chemical oceans. The only signs of advanced life, of life of any kind indeed, were a string of city-sized structures arranged in a chain along the equatorial region of the main continent. The nature and composition of these structures was virtually impossible to read from orbit. The heretics had concentrated their invasion efforts on the three largest structures, and Admiral Spatian was targeting these areas, judging that the enemy would not be wasting time invading unviable sites. Losses were high. The approaches were thick with enemy interceptors, micro-mines, and the fire of surface-to-air defences. All of this was human warfare. There was no sign or hint of any Saruthi participation at all. Behind the main landing force came the Inquisitorial squads, five specialized assault units designed to follow the military in through the opening they made and oversee the primary objectives. The capture or destruction of the heretic conspirators, and the obliteration of any further Necrochuk material. I had control of one squad. The others were led by Endor, Shongard, Molitor, and Lord Inquisitor Rorkin himself. Voke was too ill to command the squad, and his emissary, Haldane, accompanied Endor's party. My own force, designated Purge II, was made up of 20 Gudrunite riflemen, Bequin, Midas, and a Death Watch space marine called Gilar. A member of the Adeptus Astartes had been seconded to each Inquisitor. Fischig had demanded to accompany me, but he was still weak from his injuries and surgery, and I had turned him down with a heavy heart. He remained on the battleship with Amos, who was, by any standards, a non-combatant. Our transport, an Imperial Guard dropship, left the St. Sithus directly behind the force designated Purge I in Lord Rorkin's lander. We rode out the vibrating, shuddering descent, strapped into the G-chairs of the troop bay. Yerus's men sang as we dropped. Their standard-issue Gudrunite uniforms had been augmented with fresh body armor from the fleet stores, and they had sewn inquisitorial emblems onto their sleeves next to the regimental badge of the 50th Gudrunite Rifles. They were in good humor, eager and determined, encouraged, I believe, by the faith I had shown in selecting them. Madathine had confided to me that they had scored consistently above average in the adverse training program. They joked and boasted and rang out imperial battle hymns like veterans. Their experiences since the founding at Dorsay had baptized them very quickly indeed. Bequin had also been transmuted by experience in the months since I had first met her on Hubris. A hard, serious woman had replaced the scatty, selfish pleasure girl from the Sundome, as if she had at last found a calling that suited her. She had certainly thrown herself into her new life with dedication and vigour. I considered the changes a distinct improvement. Many are called to the service of our beloved Emperor, and many are found wanting. Despite the ordeals, Elizabeth Bequin had proved herself. If there was a point at which her transformation could be identified, it was the plateau. The sight of Mandragore's corpse had exorcised her fears. Dressed in a black armored body glove and a long black velvet coat, she sat in the seat next to me, scrupulously checking her las carbine. The chastener had trained her well. Her gloved hands made swift, professional movements over the weapon. Only the trim of black feathers around her coat's collar betrayed a vestige of the painted, frocked, and decorated girl of old. Midas sat the other side of me, ill at ease. He made a lousy passenger, and I knew he wanted to be up in the dropship's cockpit instead of the Navy pilot. He wore his cerise jacket, despite the objections of the Dur Gilar, who considered its brash color unsuitable for combat. His needle pistols were holstered, and his long Glavian rifle rested across his knees. I wore brown leather body armor and my button-sleeve coat for the assault, a trade-off between protection and mobility. The symbols of my office were proudly displayed on my chest above my sash. Librarian Britnoth, in a gesture that honored me, had sent a bolt pistol for my personal use. It was a compact, hand-crafted model with a casing of matte green steel. The rectangular pattern magazine slid into the hand grip, and I had one locked in place and another eight in the loops of my belt. After 8 minutes of violent descent, we leveled out, and the vibrations diminished. Gilar, seated next to the ramp hatch, made the sign of the Aquila in the air and locked his helmet into place.
20 seconds, the pilot announced over the cabin vox.
We soared down free of the clouds and into the fire and darkness of the near-surface war zone, moving at full burn towards one of the orbitally identified city structures. The site was ringed by a series of what seemed to be colossal lakes or reservoirs, and the liquid they contained was ablaze, with raging walls of fire reaching up thousands of meters. Night-black smoke fanned from the fires and blocked the immediate daylight, and the world below was amber-lit by the seething flames and the crossfire of weapons. The dropship shook as the braking jets fired, and we lurched around in a drunken yaw before settling. Gilar thumped a wall stud, and the ramp doors opened with a yowl of metal on metal. Cold air and smoke blew into the cabin. We came out onto a wide, glistening flat of white mud that squelched wetly under our running, jumping boots. The mudflats lay between two of the burning lakes, and we could feel the heat of the immense fires on our faces. The coiling flames reflected in dazzling patterns off the wet mud. Burning debris from a crashed lander littered the white flats, as well as the charred bodies of several Maiapois. Lasfire cut the air above us. A kilometer ahead, there were the familiar shapes of raised, hoop-like arches. Tetragates, as they had been dubbed by the fleet's tech priests, some shattered and broken by the assault. Beyond them rose the pearl-white flanks of a great edifice, the target structure, curved and segmented like a gigantic seashell, spotted with 1,000 tiny scorch marks and blast scars. We advanced behind Gilar. The air smelled of fuel vapor and another rich scent, like licorice, that I couldn't readily identify.
Purge 2, deploying on surface at chart mark 7, I reported over the vox. Understood, Purge 2. Purge 1 and Purge 4 report safe landing and deployment.
So, Rorkan and Molitor's groups were down. No word yet of Endor or Shongard. As we pushed past the first of the shattered hoops, Gilar faltered, pausing to shake his helmeted head. I could feel the wrongness already, the insidious twisting of the Ceruthi environment. It seemed likely the effect was being accentuated by the broken tetragates. These silent devices projected and sustained the Ceruthi tetrascapes, and they were now faulty and incomplete. The Gudranites noticed it too, but seemed unfazed.
Take point, I told Yarus, and Gilar looked at me sharply. You need time to get used to this, Brother Gilar. Don't argue.
Yarus and three Gudranites moved into the vanguard. Even they were having trouble, shambling awkwardly as if intoxicated. The angles of space and time were truly bent and twisted here. Behind us, thrusters retched, and our dropship rose off the gleaming mud, its ramp and landing struts folding up into its belly. It was barely 60 meters up when a missile struck it amidships and blew out its mainframe. The burning cockpit section tumbled away from the airburst and fell into a lake of fire. Metal debris from the destroyed main section peppered the white mud below. But for the grace of the God Emperor, we could all have been aboard it. Moving at an unsteady trot, we came to the Ceruthi edifice. Its great luminous form was the size of an imperial hive, and its foundations ran down beneath the white mud. I tried to get a sense of the structure, but it was no good, and I quickly gave up rather than risk disorientation. It was like an ammonite with its polished segments and perfect curves, but my human eyes could not read its true shape. The overlaps and edges did not meet as one would expect, and conjured distracting optical illusions when any attempt was made to follow them from one point to another. We reached the foot of it. There were no doors or entrances, and those who had come before us had tried to blast their way through the lustrous surface, only to find it apparently solid within. I moved my squad back from the barrier, and we retraced our approach down the line of the tetragates. Those nearest to the structure were still intact. As I had anticipated, we stepped through the last one and were immediately inside the edifice, as if we had passed through the pearly walls. Inside, there was a low radiance shed by some source inside the walls. It was warm, and the smell of licorice was more pungent and intense. The floor, translucent and pearly, was concave and flowed up into the curve of the walls. We moved forward, weapons ready. The corridor, and I use that word in the loosest sense, seemed to describe a spiral, like the inner form of a great conch or the canals of a human ear, but at no time did we feel anything but upright. Opening into a horn-like cone, the spiral gave out into a huge, almost spherical chamber. It was impossible to estimate its true size or define its true shape. It seemed to be some kind of ornamental garden or even farm. Silver walkways, suspended invisibly by gravity or some other force, ran between curving tanks of liquid that formed beds for huge, multicolored cycads and other bulbous, primitive plants. The fleshy growths towered around us, dripping with moisture and swathed in creepers and climbing succulents. Ropes of vine and beards of flowering foliage hung from invisible fixtures in the air above the beds. There were insects in here, flitting between the swollen bell shapes, crescents, and columns of the gigantic vegetation. One landed on my sleeve, and I swatted it, noticing with revulsion that it had 5 legs, 3 wings, and no symmetry. We followed the silver path. It passed through a tetragate, and at once we found ourselves in another garden chamber, similarly filled with glossy, abundant plant life, thriving in sculptural tanks. The tallest growths in here, giant yellowish horsetails streaked with orange veins, rose 80 or 90 meters above the floating pathway. Gilar called a word of alarm, and his storm bolter began to fire, raking across this second chamber from the silver path on which we walked. The shots burst gourd-like plants in fibrous bursts of sap and hacked shreds of leaf and tendril into the air. Return fire came at us, las fire and the crack of auto-rifles. Through the sickly growths of this indoor jungle, the soldiers of the heretics moved against us. Chapter 24 Purge 2 engages. A silent revolution. Datso's triumph. They came through the plant growth along the silver paths, blasting, men clad in the stained uniforms of the 50th Gudrunite Rifles and the black armor of the Naval Security Detail. 2 of the Gudrunites in my squad toppled and fell from the path, their corpses disappearing into the oily waters of the tanks below. But most of the enemy gunfire was going wild. Purge 2 countered, las guns barking. I moved to the front of the group and began firing my bolt pistol. There was precious little room for maneuver on the silver walkway, and even less cover. My first shot went wide, so wide I wondered if the bolter was misaligned. Then I remembered the devious nature of the Ceruthi tetrascape, and compensated. 2 shots, 2 satisfying hits. Bequin and Midas both had the trick of it too, and Yerusis' boys were learning. Gilar made a lot of noise, ripping through the gardens with his storm bolter, but it seemed to me he was still discomforted by the environment. It was a salutary moment, to see one of the godlike warriors I have regarded with great awe ever since the day, 30 years ago, when I watched the White Scars take Almanadai, become fallible. For all his power, courage, superhuman vigor, and advanced weapons, he was achieving nothing, whereas Yeltun, the youngest of the Gudrun boys, had made 3 kills already. Was it arrogance? Overconfidence in his own abilities? "Gilar! Brother Gilar! Adjust your fire!" I heard him curse something about insolence and move ahead down the path, detonating plant bulks with his shots.
"Why doesn't the bastard listen?"
Midas complained, sighting his Glavian rifle and decapitating a heretic trooper at 100 meters.
"Close up!" I ordered. "Yerus, frag them!"
Yerus and 3 others began to lob frag grenades over the thickets. Explosive flashes blew water ooze and vegetable matter up from the tanks, and the air became foggy with plant fiber and sappy moisture. There was an abrupt change in tone in the enemy fire. The boom of a bolter rang out over the crack and snipe of the laser weapons. I looked down the silver path in time to see Gilar jerk backwards as multiple bolter rounds struck his chest plate. With a cry of rage rather than pain, he went over, off the path, into the bubbling water of the tank behind us, and vanished. Thrusting the heretic foot soldiers out of the way, his killer came down the pathway towards us.
"Oh, no!" Bequin cried. "Please, by the Golden Throne, no!"
Another of the Emperor's children, the brother, if not the twin, of Foul Mandragore. His scintillating cloak blew out behind him, and his steel-shod hooves shook the path. He was bellowing like a bull auroch. His bolter spat, and the Gudrunite beside me burst apart. The children of the Emperor, shadowy sponsors of this entire enterprise, were here to protect their investment. Had they come unbidden after Mandragore's death? Had Datso or Locke summoned them? I fired the bolter at him, joining the fusillade of desperate weapons blasts that Purge 2 leveled in a frantic attempt to slow him down. Fear made the men forget the best of their training.
and many of the shots were wild. He didn't seem to feel those few that struck his armor.
"Purge Two! This is Purge Two! The children of the Emperor are here!" I yelled into my vox. I knew I would be dead in an instant. It was imperative that Fleet Command knew of this dire development. A black shape burst up from the dark water, cascading froth and ooze in all directions. Brother Gilar slammed into the Chaos Marine, wrenching him over, and they both fell thrashing into the adjacent tank. Something, probably the heretic's bolter, fired repeatedly underwater, and the side of the tank below the floating path splintered out in a rush of liquid. The soupy water flooded out, draining away into the gullies between the garden structures. As the fluid level dropped, the titanic combatants emerged, blackened with mire, wrestling and trading inhuman blows among the tangled roots and feeder tubes of the tank's murky bottom. Ceramite-cased fists pounded into armor plates. Chips of plasteel flew from the impacts. The Chaos Marine's vast paws clawed at Gilar, tearing at his visor and shoulder guards. Gilar drove him backwards, his feet churning in the shallow, thick water. They slammed in the bowl of a cycad. The enemy grappled, getting a better grip, stabbing a jagged gauntlet spike through the armpit seal of the Death Watch's Imperata armor. Gilar staggered, and as he fell back, a massive backhanded slap knocked him over and tore his helmet off. The Chaos Marine landed on the sprawling Gilar, tearing at his throat, driving fists like boulders into his face. There was a bang of weapon discharge and a flash. His face destroyed, and his collapsed skull burning from the inside, the Chaos filth fell back into the swamp water. Gilar rose unsteady, his storm bolter in his hand, blood pouring from the wounds in his face and neck. It was a formidable victory. Yerus and his men cheered and whooped, and then renewed their advance on the remaining heretics. The enemy, resolve lost, pulled back and vanished into the dense thickets of the gardens. Dripping, Gilar climbed back onto the path and looked down at me. "I'm glad you're still with us, Brother Gilar," I said. We traced the paths on through the gardens of the Ceruthi, unopposed. The enemy dead we passed, floating in the tanks or sprawled on the pathways, had signs of branding on their faces. Chaos marks, burned into the skin by evil rather than heat. Admiral Spatian had hoped that some of the heretic forces, especially the Gudronite Imperial Guard, might yet be restored to the Imperial cause. Like Yerus and his men, most had been unwilling pawns caught up in Estrom's treason, and the fleet tacticians had presented models of victory wherein Locke and Datso found the bulk of their ground forces turning against them. Such a hope was dashed. The minds of these good men had been burned away and poisoned by chaos. The heretics had enforced the loyalty of their stolen armies. Via Tetragates we advanced, passing through six more garden spheres, then on into wide tiled courtyards and halls of asymmetrical pillars whose function we could not imagine. Twice we had brief skirmishes with heretic forces, driving them back into the warped cavities of the edifice. More often we could hear ferocious war, full-blown battles that seemed right at hand, but of which there was no visual or physical trace. Contact with Fleet Command was fragmentary. Purge One, Lord Rawkin's party, was locked in combat somewhere, and nothing had been heard of Molitor's Purge Four. Shongard's group, Purge Five, was lost somewhere in the Tetrascape. Plaintive calls for aid came from them at irregular intervals, piteous half-sane ramblings about impossible spaces and spirals of madness. From Titus Endor we heard nothing. The main surface war still raged. Maiapua commanders reported gains along the firelegs that edged the target edifices, one of which was reportedly beginning to implode, as if great harm had been done to it internally. In a vault of smooth polished beige that seemed to us to have no ceiling, we found our first Ceruthi. They were dead, a dozen of them, their grey bulk split and mauled, silver stilts torn off. Through the next gate lay a spiral room littered with 100 more. Moving among the grey dead, their pallid limbs dripping with ichor, were several of the white slave beasts that had carried the Necrochuke onto the plateau. They seemed to me to have broken free, as many dragged their wire restraints. Some had taken up silver stilts and were stabbing them slowly and repeatedly into the corpses of their grey masters. I wondered if the pitiful white things were a separate race, enslaved by the Ceruthi, or a bastardized mutant caste kept in servitude.
The invasion, it seemed, had freed them to turn on their owners and butcher them. Such is the price of slavery, sooner or later. The slave things offered us no threat. They didn't even appear to notice the humans moving amongst them. With silent, methodical determination, they mutilated the bodies of the Ceruthi. In another chamber, an oval dish with tessellated tiles and a strangely warm atmosphere, living Ceruthi milled aimlessly in their hundreds. Some had lost stilts and were limping. Others lay in trembling masses, their skulls flopped back on their bodies. The smell of licorice, or whatever it was, reeked here. As we watched, white slave things lumbered into the chamber through another tetragate and began to twist apart and maul the Ceruthi, one by one, with the calm, methodical motions of insects. The Ceruthi offered no resistance. This story was repeated in other chambers and curving halls. Ceruthi lay dead or meandering without purpose, freed slaves finding them by touch and dismembering them. I wonder, even now, as to the meaning of these alien scenes. Had the Ceruthi given up, resigned to their doom, or had some other circumstance stolen their will to live and resist? Not even the tech priests or the xenobiologists could provide an answer. There is, ultimately, only the fact of their alien nature, abstract, inscrutable, and beyond the capacity of the human mind to fathom. When we found the archpriest Dutzo, he was close to death. A battle of titanic proportions had taken place in the tetrascape where he lay. Thousands of dead lay on the tiled floor, Mayapua infantry and heretic troops alike. Two children of the Emperor and three Death Watch were among the fallen. The tetrascape, by far the largest of any we had seen in the edifice, reached away beyond the curve of all human dimensions, and the jumbled corpses covered the endless floor into infinity. Dazzo lay at the foot of an asymmetrical block that rose from the tiles like a standing stone. His body was torn by gunshot wounds. Heldane sat nearby, his back to the great block, guarding the archpriest with an auto-pistol. Heldane's torso was smirched in blood, and his breathing was labored. He saw us approach through the tetragate and lowered the gun weakly. "What happened here, Heldane?"
"A battle," he said, wheezing. "We came upon it as it was raging. When Inquisitor Ender saw this wretch, he drove us into the fight to reach him. It was a blur after that."
"Where's Endor?" I asked, looking around, hoping I would not see his corpse among the dead.
"Gone. Gone after Locke."
"Which way?" He pointed weakly to a tetragate on the far side of the sea of bodies. "Does Locke have the Necrochuke? The Ceruthi Necrochuke, I mean."
"No,"
Heldane said.
"But he has the primer."
"The what?"
"Dazzo got it out of this thing somehow,"
he said, slapping the stone block that supported him.
"A language primer. A translation tool. Without it, the Ceruthi version of the text is unreadable to us."
"How in the Emperor's name did he do that?"
Gilar asked.
"With his mind,"
Heldane said.
"Can't you feel that afterburn of the psychic effort?"
I found that I could. The mental taste of a mind almost burned out. The raised block was clearly another part of the Ceruthi's mysterious technology, perhaps the equivalent of an imperial cogitator, perhaps something more sentient, even something alive. Dazzo, whose psychic abilities I already knew to be monstrous, had identified it and psychically assaulted it, forcing it to give up its secrets. An extraordinary feat of the mind, a triumph of will.
"A polyhedron,"
Heldane added.
"Irregular, small, made of pearl, it seemed to me. It just came out of the block into his hands. Materialized. I saw it happening as I fought my way to them. But the effort destroyed his mind. Endor cut him down. He hadn't the strength to resist."
"How do you know it was this primer?" asked Bequin.
"I read it in his dying mind. Like I said, there is no resistance left there. See for yourself."
I crossed over to Dazzo and knelt next to him. Ragged breathing sucked in and out of his bloody mouth. I drove my mind into his, pushing aside pathetic strands of denial, and confirmed Heldane's story. With inhuman willpower, Dazzo had wrenched the language primer from the Ceruthi technology, and with it the whereabouts of the Xenos Necrochuke. Dying, he had passed both to Locke to finish the task.
"Gregor,"
Midas hissed. I turned. Far away, across the curve of the tetrascape, heretic troops were advancing through the dead. They began firing at us. Gilar and the Gudrunites fired back, taking what cover they could to resist.
"Brother Gilar, I need you to hold these bastards at bay."
"Where are you going, Inquisitor?"
he asked, sliding a fresh clip into his storm bolter.
"After Locke and Endor, to do what I can."
Chapter 25 Xenos Necrochuk. Endgame. The Blank-Eyed Man. We left the firefight behind us and plunged through the Tetragate. Beckwin, Midas, and I, racing as fast as we could through the disorienting spirals and imbricating segments of the dying Ceruthi edifice. As we ran, I reported the situation to Fleet Command, but had no reply or way of knowing if they'd understood me. Then I tried Titus Endor, but the Vox was dead. Moving at speed, the place became even more of a four-dimensional maze, but I had in my mind now the engram I had taken from Datso, the memory trace of the route to the Xenos Necrochuk he had ripped from the block. By my estimation, and it could hardly be trusted, we were approaching the heart of the edifice. Perhaps not the physical or geographic heart, but that part of the dimensional construct buried most deeply in the interlocking lamina of warped space and time. There were more Ceruthi here, skittering and clicking around on their silver limb braces without purpose or response. The smell of licorice filled the warm, glowing tunnels and tiled chambers. We heard screaming ahead of us and the thump of gunfire.
"Titus! Titus! It's Eisenhorn! Do you read?"
The Vox coughed into life.
"Gregor, for the love of the Emperor, I need—"
It broke again. More shots. We hurried through a tetragate and almost at once had to dive for cover as lasfire flurried around us. The chamber we had entered was by no means the largest we had found in the place, but it was singular. Dark and gloomy, it lacked the radiance that shone from the walls and floors elsewhere. The lustrous material that composed the rest of the edifice was here, grey and dissected, as if dead. Another block, like the one Haldane had been propped up against but many times the size, rose from the ashy floor, streaked with oily greenish matter that ran down its flanks and pooled at the base. An asymmetrical shelf jutted from it, just above the height of an average human, and a blue octahedron sat upon it, glowing internally.
The Xenos Necrochuk.
Datso's engram immediately confirmed it. The chamber stank with its evil, the licorice smell, so rich and cloying it made us gag. Behind and above the main pillar, warped sculptures of metal, bone, and other organic materials grew from the walls and curving roof. Vicious hooks on filthy chains dangled from these outgrowths. This was not Ceruthi handiwork, but a touch of pure chaos, spawned by the Necrochuk, infecting the Xenos fabric of its sanctum. Smaller pillars, irregular and unmatched, dotted the floor around the main block. In between them, a gunfight was raging. The three of us ran from the exposure of the lit tetragate and found shelter behind the nearest of the smaller blocks. Las shots wove in and out of the stone shapes, ricocheting and rebounding.
"Titus! Gregor!"
He was 20 meters away, a third of the way into the chamber, huddled behind a block and firing his las pistol at figures closer to the Necrochuk's resting place. I glimpsed Locke and 8 or 9 heretic troopers. I looked to either side of me at Beckwin and Midas.
"Choose your targets," I told them.
We began to fire in support of Endor, dropping at least one of the heretics. As they reeled from the salvo, Endor leapt up and ran forward. A las shot clipped him and blew him back against a stone upright. I ran forward myself, firing my bolt pistol, which I had braced in both hands. I blew chunks from the blocks ahead of me and hit at least one of the enemy gunners. I reached Endor. He was wounded in the chest. It would be fatal if we couldn't get him clear quickly. I pulled him into cover and waited while Beckwin ran up through the rows to my side.
"Pressure here," I said, showing her, my hands wet with my old friend's blood. She did as she was told.
I became aware of thunderous noises from beyond the chamber. The place shook. More thunder rolled, and a section of the curved ceiling suddenly splintered and collapsed, cascading wreckage down, allowing cold exterior light to shaft in. A second later, 3 more holes ruptured and burst through the roof, and from outside I could hear the muffled hammering of bombardment.
"Midas!"
He was already moving up to my left, ditching his needle rifle for the pistols in the tight confines. Lethal Glavian needles hissed through the air. The ground continued to shake. A further section of roof came down. Leaving Endor with Bequin, I ducked from pillar to pillar, braving the deluge of shots. Midas and I switched to our earpiece links in Glossier.
Thorn ushers Aegis, a Tempest sinister. Aegis attending. Tempest in three.
I counted the three beats and ran forward as Midas hurled his frag grenade to my left before opening fire with both pistols. The flash and bang of the blast obscured the bombardment outside for a moment. A heretic was flung upwards, limbs flailing, and glanced brokenly off a pillar before hitting the ground. Midas's tempest of covering confusion had allowed me to get within 10 meters of Locke. I could no longer see him, however. Keeping my grip on my bolt pistol, I drew my power sword in my left hand and came around the block. Locke and one of his men had chosen the exact same moment to plough forward into me. We broke from cover and came face to face in the narrow gap between pillars. My pistol's first shot missed the lunging Locke and tore the left arm off his accomplice. Before the wailing man had even hit the ground, Locke's las pistol had put a round through the meat of my right arm. A long-bladed dagger flashed forward in his other hand. We slammed into each other. I tried to sweep my power sword around, but it struck something, and Locke sidestepped. The basket hilt of his dagger smashed into my face and knocked me over onto my back. With a grin that he knew I could never copy, he raised his las pistol to fire down into my brain. 2 tons of Xenos quarried stone pillar sliced through at hip height by my power blade, crushed him into the flaking ground. I rose. Gorgon Locke was still alive. His belly and pelvis were smashed under the fallen pillar, and his arms were pinned. He gazed up at me through blinking, bewildered eyes. Gorgon Locke, in the eyes of the Holy Inquisition, you are thrice damned by action, association, and belief, I said, beginning the catechism of abolition.
No,
he whispered. As I completed the exclamation, I cut the mark of heresy into the flesh of his brow with the tip of my sword. By the time I had finished, he was dead from his crush injuries. The shattering chamber still shook. On their long chains, the hooks swung. Dust and fragments dribbled down from the tears in the roof, falling through the bars of cold light. I reached down and found the pearl polyhedron in Locke's blood-soaked coat. The primer. I slipped it into my pocket and turned to see Midas approaching.
"The last of his rats have fled," he said, holstering his pistols. He looked down at the dead shipmaster. "So perish all heretics, eh?"
I reached up with one hand to take the Xenos Necrotuke from its shelf and found myself unable to move. Some enormous psychic force froze me rigid.
"So perish all heretics indeed," said a voice. "Turn him so he can see me."
Involuntarily, I swung round, my hand still raised in the act of reaching out. I saw Midas, also paralyzed and rigid, his dark features locked in a rictus of dismay. Conrad Molitor, my brother Inquisitor, was standing before me, smiling. His 3 hooded servants were at his side.
"Such valor, Gregor! Such dedication! I thought you'd be the one to find the prize."
I tried to answer, but my mouth refused to obey me. Spittle bubbled between my clenched teeth. Molitor looked around at his cowled companions.
"Let him speak," he said.
The psychic constraints on my voice slackened. Speech was still an effort.
"What are you doing, Molitor?"
"Recovering the priceless Necrotuke, of course. We really, really can't have you destroying another copy now, can we?"
"We?"
"There are many who believe mankind will benefit more from the study of this artifact than from its destruction. I have come to safeguard those interests."
Rorkan will never allow. You will burn for—"
"My estimable Lord Brother Rorkan will never know. Feel how this place quakes. See how the roof splinters and collapses. 10 minutes ago, I signaled to the fleet that the primary objective was achieved. I gave the code for Sanction Extremis. They believe the Necrotuke had been found and safely disposed of. Our forces are withdrawing, with all haste. The batteries of the fleet have begun to level these Xenos places. No one will know that the Divine Necrotuke has been carried off safely. Not a shred of evidence will survive the bombardment. Not a shred of evidence. nor any voice of dissent."
His yellow-pupiled eyes regarded me.
"How brave of you to give your life in the assault on 56 Izar. Your name will be remembered on the roll of honour, I assure you. I'll see to that myself."
"Bastard!"
I fought with my mind to break free, but it was impossible. This was not Molitor's hold on me, one of his retainers, or all three in concert, supremely powerful.
"Fetch it for me," Molitor said to one of his men, gesturing to the Necrochuk with a wave of his checked sleeve. "We would be well to leave promptly."
The hammering bombardment was now a perpetual shaking roar. The robed figure slid forward and took down the blue octahedron, cupping it in elegant, long-nailed fingers. He seemed to study it and looked round at Molitor.
"It is useless," he said.
"What?"
"Unreadable. Locked within an impenetrable Xenos language code."
Molitor stammered.
"No! Impossible! Break the code!" "Would that I could. It is beyond even my ability."
"There must be a means of translation." The hooded man holding the Necrochuk looked round at me.
"He has a primer. The only primer. He's trying not to think about it, but I can see it in his mind. Look in his coat pocket."
The smile returned to Molitor's face. He came close to me, reaching out a hand towards my coat.
"Devious to the last, Gregor. You whoreson wretch."
A lasround blew his hand off at the wrist. Molitor screamed and stumbled back, clutching his smoking stump. Beckwin, her face pursed grimly, her las carbine at her shoulder and aimed at his heart, appeared beside me.
"Kill them! Kill them!"
Molitor screamed. I felt the immediate pressure of the psychic vice tightening to finish me. Then I reeled away, freed. The psychic blank of Beckwin's untouchable nature shielded me now she was at my side. The servant holding the Necrochuk took a step backwards in surprise. Molitor, frantic with pain and anger, saw that his powerful psychic was thwarted somehow and yelled,
"Albart! Albara! The hearts!"
Code words. Trigger words. The pair of servants who had remained by his side sprang forward, their robes shredding away. Arcoflagellants. Heretics reprogrammed and rebuilt with augmetics and bionics to serve as murderous slaves. The trigger words woke them from their calming states of bliss and plunged them into maniacal rages. Out of their robes they were foul, hunched things, encrusted with crude surgical implants and sacred charms. Their hands were lashing clutches of electro-whips, their eyes, dull, bulbous orbits, under the rims of the tarnished pacifier helmets, bolted to their skulls. Midas, Beckwin, and I fired our weapons together, raking them with punishment as they charged forward. The damage they suffered was immense, but still they came on, their bodies pumped with intoxicating adrenal fluid, pain blockers and frenzy-inducing chemical stimulants. They didn't feel what we were doing to them. One was just an arm's length from me, when my desperate rain of bolts finally defeated it. A shot exploded the armored matrix of chemical dispensers on its shoulder, spraying fluid into the air. In a second, it fell convulsing to the ground at our feet, as the damage robbed it of its drug source and left nothing but agony behind. The other barely felt the punctures of Midas's two subtle needles. Frantically, we split to either side, out of its path. Braying and thrashing its whip limbs, it pounded after Midas, who ducked left and right between pillars, trying to evade it. Only his Glavian-bred grace and speed kept him out of its inexorably advancing grip. He knew he had seconds left. Beckwin and I were moving, but there was precious little we could do. Midas pulled off his pouch of grenades, priming one as he twisted and sidestepped between the pillars, scarcely avoiding a withering lash of flexible metal whips that scored gouges in the stone. Midas feinted left and then threw himself directly at the beast, snagging the strap of his pouch around its neck as he vaulted over its shoulder head first. The grenades detonated in one stunning flash and atomized the ravening man-beast. Caught in the shockwave, Midas was thrown into a pillar and dropped unconscious.
"Eisenhorn! Eisenhorn!"
Molitor was wailing as he and his remaining servant hunted for me. His voice was cracking with pain and fury. "Stay at my side," I told Beckwin as we ran deeper into the chamber. "That psychic can't touch me while I'm close to you." Half the ceiling and a significant part of the wall blew in. For a second, the air was solid with billowing orange fire. Deafened, our skins scorched by the blast, Beckwin and I were back on our feet in a moment. The chamber was open to the sky now, and cold white light poured in, heavy with smoke.
Come on!
Together we scrambled towards the blast-damaged wall, picking our way up the smouldering slope of broken stone and whatever material the Ceruthi used for construction. This material was fused and bubbling, like plastic or flesh. We headed for the light. We emerged high on the curving upper face of the Ceruthi edifice. It was cold, and the wind that came across the segmented ridges of the polished white roof was brisk and full of the odors of smoke, physalene, and promethium. We were at a dizzying height. The pearly flanks of the vast structure arced away to a ground far below, and the surface was hard and polished, like ice. Beckwin slipped, and I managed to grab her before she slid away down the curve. From up here, high in the alien sky, we could see across the lakes of fire and the vast smoke banks that roiled away for hundreds of kilometers. We could see flocks of troop ships soaring up and away through the smoke cover towards the parent ships in orbit. On the flats of white mud far beneath us, Imperial troops ran to waiting dropships, discarding packs and helmets and even weapons in their haste to leave. Tanks and armored carriers wallowed and puffed through the wet mud and up onto the tongue-like ramps of heavy lifters. Shells and lasfire flickered across the lakes and mud as the remaining heretic forces fought on heedless. Lances and forks of dazzling energy bit down from the clouds, murdering the landscape. Obeying Molitor's instructions to the letter, Admiral Spatian was leveling the area. All five of us Inquisitors, along with Seinwolf and Key Deathwatch, and selected officers of the invasion force, had been given the code words to unleash this doom. Molitor had sealed our fate. Once given, Sanction Extremis could not be revoked, even if my Vox had been working, instead of crippled by the electromagnetic bursts that accompanied every orbital strike. As per the battle plans, Spatian was systematically wasting the invasion site as fast as possible, even at the cost of his own retreating ground forces. Another Ceruthi edifice, 20 kilometers away, died. Shaped in a form that suggested a Nautilus shell, its opalescent curves were cracked and split by blue-hot heavy lasers. The die-straight beams came down through the clouds from ships so far up they were invisible, and tore through the edifice like testamental judgment. Waves of fighter bombers swept in, sowing payloads of munitions that bloomed in rippling seas of explosions. Guided warheads, sleek like airborne sharks, whined overhead on the last stage of their first and final journey from starship to target. The edifice ruptured and blew out. Light shock lit the hemisphere. A towering column of white ash smoke rose, folding into a 15-kilometer torus-shaped cloud. The sight was stunning. Shocking. Beckwin and I gazed at it. A few heartbeats later, it was repeated behind us, 40 kilometers distant, as another Ceruthi edifice was annihilated. The edifice on whose smoothly curving upper surfaces we now stood was undoubtedly going to go the same way soon. Even now, I knew, the coordinates were being loaded into the fleet's gunnery servitors. We ran along the lip of another curved segment. Afterburners red against the black smoke, more dropships came in, heading towards cheering, gesticulating huddles of Mirepoix infantry out on the flats. I was astounded at the selfless courage of the dropship crews. Spatian's bombardment wasn't waiting for them to move in and pull out. They were risking everything to make the surface run and retrieve as many troopers as they could. "Gregor!" Beckwin shouted in my ear. I turned. Down the shell-form span of the roof behind us, Molitor and his henchmen had appeared out of the blast hole. Unsteady, they scrambled up after us. A las shot whined past me, kissing the pearly surface and leaving a burn scar.
"The primer, you horse and bastard! Give me the primer!"
Molitor yelled. I gave him a full clip of bolt rounds instead. The first of the thundering tracer shots splintered chunks out of the edifice roof. Then I hit and exploded his left thigh, his belly, and his throat. Conrad Molitor bucked and twitched as the rounds tore through him, and then fell. His mauled body slid down the curve of the roof and disappeared, leaving a smear of blood behind it. His henchmen advanced, heedless of the shots, throwing off his hooded robe. He was naked beneath it, tall, well-muscled, with a golden cast to his skin. His face was handsome, and tiny residual horns sprouted from his skull. His eyes were blank. My prophetic dreams were made flesh. Terror seized me, turned my heart inside out.
Chapter 26 Cherubael The Brink Exterminatus The blank-eyed man, though in truth he was not a man, but a demon in human form, strode up the shining curve towards me. The glowing octahedron of the Ceruthi's unholy text was clasped in one nimble hand.
"I would like the primer now, please, Gregor."
"What are you?"
"This is no place for introductions,"
he gestured about himself. Lances of annihilation blasted down into the mud flats nearby. "Humor me," I managed.
"Very well. My name is Cherubael. Now, that primer, time is ticking away."
"Time will always tick away," I said. "Who made you?"
"Made me?"
The blank-eyed man smiled at me duplicitously. "You're a demon host, a conjured thing. Tell me who made you and who commanded you and Molitor to come after this prize, and I might give you the primer." He laughed and licked his thin lips with a glossy, forked tongue.
"Let us both be abundantly clear about this, Gregor. You will give me the primer. Either you will hand me the primer now, or I will come over to you and take it, and break every bone in your body, and defile that girl at your side, and break every bone in her body too, and then drag your jiggling carcasses down into the chamber below, and string you both up on the hooks, and burn out your agony centers as I wait for the bombardment to flatten this place."
He paused.
"Your choice."
"You've been in my dreams for a long while now. Why is that?" I pressed.
"You are gifted, Gregor, and time is not the arrow that humans like to think it is. A second in the warp would show you that. Why, a second in the four-dimensional habitats of the Ceruthi should have proved it too. Your dreams were just nightmares of something yet to happen."
"Who made you?" My voice was insistent. His answer was the one I least expected, and it left me all but stunned.
"The Holy Inquisition made me, Gregor. A brother of yours made me. Now, for the last time, give me that."
The demon host swung around suddenly, as voices called out from lower down the roof. Brother Captain Seinwolf was clambering up out of the blast hole, flanked by Midas and another Death Watcher, carrying the limp form of Titus Endor. Seinwolf raised his storm bolter and fired at the blank-eyed man. Cherubael reached out and caught the glowing shells, plucking them out of the air.
"Go home, Astartes bastard,"
he yelled down the sloping roof at Seinwolf.
"This has nothing to do with you."
The fiend came up the ridge until he was facing me. I could see the tiny arcs of power darting across his glowing skin. I could smell the stink of corruption. Eye to eye now. He held out his hand, palm up, fingernails long and polished like claws.
"Clever of you to find it untouchable to cancel me out."
He looked over at Bequin.
"How did you manage that?"
"Fate, like time, is not linear, Cherubael. Surely you know that. I found Bequin in the same way that the dreams of you found me." He nodded.
"I like you, Gregor Eisenhorn. So very challenging and stimulating for a human. I wish we had leisure to discourse and break bread, but we haven't,"
he snapped suddenly.
"Give me the primer."
I took out the polyhedron. His smile broadened. I dropped the artifact onto the silky roof, and, before it could slide away, crushed it under the heel of my boot. The demon host took a step backwards, gazing down at the crunched dust. He looked up at me again with his blank eyes.
"You are a man of singular dedication, Gregor. I would have enjoyed killing you when the day and hour came. But you're dead already. This edifice is 240 seconds away from destruction. Cherish this."
He tossed me the Xenos Necrotuke, and I caught it in one gloved hand.
"You've won. Take that consolation to the afterlife."
He started to run towards the lip of the roof, and then threw himself out in a perfect dive, arms raised. For a moment, he hung in space. Then he forked his body in, executed a precise roll, and disappeared into the lake of fire below. I pulled Bequin to me as Seinwolf, Midas, and the other Death Watch Marine approached. Endor, crumpled in the Astartes' arms, looked dead. I prayed he was, for in a moment this place would dissolve in fire.
Rose Thorn from Aegis above, and, well, above for Emperor's sake. Damn this glossier crap. Move!
My gun cutter swung in over the edifice roof, ramp jaws open. I could see Fischig at the helm through the cockpit screens, yelling at me. Amos was at his side. I watched 56 Izar die from the bridge of the St. Sithis as we left orbit. Petals of flame the size of continents spread out under its milky skin. Sanction extremis. Exterminatus. After the deluge of fire, the virus bombs, the seething storms of tailored plagues, the nuclear atrocity. It was a cinder by the time we left. No contact with the Saruthi race was ever made again. And the tainted, glowing light of the Necrochuke was extinguished forever. Epilogue. At Pamafrey. At Pamafrey we rested. 40 weeks of voyage through the Immaterium had dulled our sense of victory. The fleet dispersed at Thracian Primaris, and the last I saw of Sergeant Yeros was a waving hand across a smoky, beery bar. I rented a villa out by the sound at Pamafrey. Midas slept most of the day, and whiled away the night in games of regicide with Amos and Fischig. Beckwin bathed in the sun and swam in the breakers. I sat out on the salt-whipped stoop and watched over the beach like a god who has forgotten his creations. Great labours still awaited us. Reports to be made, interviews and debriefings to be attended. Lord Rawkin had called for a tribunal of inquiry, and the High Lords of Terra were awaiting a full account of the matter. Months of paperwork, hearings and evidential audits lay ahead. The identity of the force behind Molitor and his demon host remained a mystery, and though Lord Rawkin was as anxious as myself to find an answer, I doubted any would readily emerge. The question might fester and stagnate, unanswered, in the slow, unwieldy bureaucracy of the Inquisition for years. I would not allow that. As soon as I was free to engage upon another case, I would dedicate myself to finding Cherubael's master. The beloved rule of man had come close to great calamity, thanks to his scheming. I would not forget the Saruthi. They were an object lesson, if any were truly needed, of how an entire advanced culture might be consumed by chaos. Seabirds looped in the gusting tide wind. The breakers crashed. The blank-eyed man still haunted my dreams. After echoes, or ripples of the future? I would have to wait and see. That was Eisenhorn, Xenos, by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2016. By order of His Most Holy Majesty the God Emperor of Terra, sequestered inquisitorial dossiers, authorized persons only. Case file 112:67B:AA6:XAD. Please enter your authority code. Validating. Thank you, Inquisitor. You may proceed. Verbal transcript of picked recorded document. Location: Maginor. Date: 239M41. Recovered from servitor recording module. Transcribed by savant Eledix. Ordo Hereticus Inquisitorial Data Library Faculty, Phibos Secundus. 240M41. Picked record white noise segues to darkness. Sounds of distant human pain. A flash of light, pos las fire. Sounds of running. Picked source moves. Tracking, vibrating. Some stone walls in close focus. Another flash, brighter, closer. Squeal of pain, source unknown. An extremely bright flash. Loss of picture. Image indistinct for 2:38. Some background noise. A man, subject 1, in long robes, calls out as he strides past close to the picked source, speech unrecoverable. Surroundings, dark stone, pos, tunnel, tomb. One's identity, unknown, partial face view only. Picked source moves in close behind one, observing as one draws a force hammer from a thigh loop under his robe. Close up on one's hands as he grips haft. Inquisitorial signet ring in plain view. One turns, face obscured by shadow. One speaks. Voice, one. Move in. Move in the name of all that's holy. Come on and... Words obliterated by sound flash. Bastard monster to death! Further flashes of light, now clearly close las impacts. Picked source filters fail to block glare. Whiteout. Image whiteout for 0:14. Resolution slowly returning. Passing in through the high stone entrance of some considerable chamber. Grey stone, rough hewn. Picked source pans. Bodies in doorway, and also slumped down interior steps. Massive injuries, mangled. Stones wet with blood. Voice off. One.
Where are you? Where are you? Show yourself.
Picked source moves in. Two human shapes move past it to left. Blurred. Image stall reveals one, subject two, to be male. Approx 40 years. Heavy set, wearing Imperial Guard issue body plate. No insignia or idents. Significant facial scarring, old. Wielding belt-fed heavy stubber. Other, subject 3, is female, approx 25 years. Svelte, skin dyed blue, tattoos and body glove armor of a Morituri death cultist initiate. Wielding force blade, approx 45 centimeters length. Blurred shapes 2 and 3 move beyond picked source. Picked source pans round, establishing sidelong view of 2 and 3 engaged in rapid hand-to-hand warfare with adversaries on lower steps. Adversaries are heterogeneous mix. 6 humans with surgical bionic implants, 2 mutants, 3 offensive servitors. See attached file record for stall frame details. 2 fires heavy stubber, soundtrack distorts. 2 human adversaries pulped. Backwash smoke haze renders image partially indistinct. 3 severs head of mutant. Vaults backwards. Transcriptional assumption. Picked source too slow to follow. And impales human adversary. Picked source moves down. Image jerky. Voice off.
Manisha, to the left! To the...
Picked source makes partial capture as 3 is hit repeatedly by energy fire. 3 convulses. Explodes. Picked source hit by blood mist. Image fogs. Image wiped clear. 2 is yelling, moving ahead out of view, firing heavy stubber. Sudden crossfire laser effect. Las flare blinds picked source optics. Various noise sources. Indistinct voices. Some screaming. Image returns. 1 is just ahead of picked source. Charging into wide flat chamber, lit by green chemical lamps. Face illuminated by light for 0:3. Subject 1, positively identified as Inquisitor Hetris Lugenbrow. Lugenbrow.
Quixos! Quixos! I put it all to the sword and the cleansing flame! Now you, monster! Now you, bastard!
Voice, unidentified.
I am here, Lugenbrow. Karnagar awaits.
Lugenbrow, 1, moves off image. Picked source pans. Image jerky. Body parts scattered on chamber floor. Composite identifies subject 2 as one of 9 corpses. Major detonations nearby. Image shakes. Picked source falls sidelong. Image blank for 1:07. Significant background noise. Image returns. Lugenbrow, partly visible off frame left, engaged in combat. Afterglow residue of force hammer blows remain burned on image for several seconds. Image indistinct. Picked source turns to focus on Lugenbrow. Lugenbrow engaged in hand-to-hand combat with unknown foe. Movements too fast for picked source to capture. Blur. Human figures, identity unknown, pos adversary troops. Move in from right frame. Heads of human figures explode. Figures topple. Whiteout. Picked source blanked. Duration unknown. Image returns. Imperfect. Jerky shots of ground and wall. Refocus blurring. Picked source reacquires Lugenbrow, an adversary in combat. Smoke fumes haze view. Combat as before too rapid for picked source to capture. Extensive background noise. Glowing line, believed to be blade weapon, impales Lugenbrow. Image shakes.
some picture loss. Lugenbrow immolates. Image burns out. Pause, picked blank, of unknown duration. Image returns. Close-up of face looking into picked source. Identity unknown. Subject, 4. 4 is handsome, sculptural, smiling. Eyes blank. Voice, 4.
Hello, little thing. I am Cherubael.
Light flash. Scream, believed to originate from picked source. Image out. Recording ends.